October 22, 1993. A medical student named Diogratius Dio Niazonkiza woke up in his room at Mutaho Hospital in northern Burundi to an eerie silence. The usual morning sounds, nurses chatting, patients shuffling, the clink of medical instruments, had vanished. Within hours, he would be hiding under his bed as militiamen crashed through corridors, their machetes gleaming, their voices chanting about warming up cockroaches, their dehumanizing term for Tutsis like him. Two shadows appeared in his doorway, scanned the room, then moved on. By nightfall, Dio was stepping over bodies in the courtyard, the hospital ablaze, beginning a six-month odyssey through landscapes soaked in blood. This wasn't supposed to be his story. He was a third-year medical student, focused on anatomy and patient care, not survival. Yet, within a single day, everything he knew dissolved into chaos, launching him on a journey that would eventually span two genocides, three continents, and the entire spectrum of human capacity for both cruelty and compassion. For 6 months, Dio navigated hell on earth, avoiding roads where bonfires burned and crowds chanted threats. Villages had transformed into nightmares, smoldering houses, murdered families, rivers running red with corpses. One image haunted him most, a baby at its dead mother's breast in a banana grove, staring at him with innocent eyes as he walked away. He couldn't help without risking his own life. His survival depended on strangers willing to risk everything. A Hutu woman hid him for weeks, despite mortal danger to her family. One act of courage among thousands of acts of brutality. Eventually, he reached Rwanda, only to find himself caught in another genocide. Through remarkable luck and compassion from people who saw his humanity rather than his ethnicity, he secured passage to America with $200, no English skills, and psychological scars that would take years to process. Landing at JFK Airport in May 1994 marked a new displacement. Immigration officials eyed his worn clothes and dubious coffee salesman cover story with suspicion. Mohamed, a French-speaking Senegalese immigrant, became his lifeline, leading him to a dilapidated Harlem tenement with no electricity, cardboard-patched windows, and garbage-strewn floors. Each night, Dio laid his possessions on the bare floor, using his jacket as a pillow. America presented baffling paradoxes. Why were poor people overweight when in Burundi only the wealthy could afford excess food? Why did people drink from brown paper bags, wear baseball caps backwards, and sag their pants? His first job search became an all-day subway odyssey, trapped in a maze of incomprehensible maps, surrounded by movement but unable to find direction. As a delivery boy earning $15 per day, he endured physical strain and casual cruelty. His employer's pointed question about African heat while watching Dio struggle under the summer sun stung deeply, his identity reduced to crude stereotypes. His meager earnings barely covered subway tokens, medication for fungal-infected feet, and antacids for stress-induced stomach problems. After exhausting days, he sought refuge in bookstores, cross-referencing English and French dictionaries until closing time, his most treasured possessions. During a church delivery, Dio met Sharon McKenna, who spoke French with him. Breaking his usual caution, he revealed he'd escaped violence in Burundi and Rwanda. Sharon arranged free medical care, bought him a bilingual Le Petit Prince and an $81 physiology textbook, and introduced him to Nancy and Charlie Wolf, a couple who became his surrogate family. The Wolf's book-filled Soho apartment became his sanctuary. Nancy, a nervous blonde artist, and Charlie, whose calm demeanor reminded Dio of his brother, insisted America was a country of second chances. They offered him their windowless black hole room. Though comfortable, Dio was haunted by vivid images of machetes and flesh, often taking cold showers to avoid nightmares. The Wolves encouraged him to quit his grocery job and helped him enroll in English classes at Hunter College. Dio cherished Saturday walks with Charlie to Union Square and evening discussions about English expressions. After 5 months, Charlie suggested Dio move to Chapel Hill, where his friend could help with university enrollment. At the train station, Nancy cried, and Charlie pulled out his handkerchief as Dio departed, secretly hoping they would ask him to stay. When North Carolina fell through, Nancy and Charlie arranged college tours. Dio fell in love with Columbia University, and they paid his $6,000 tuition for the American Language Program. Applying to Columbia's School of General Studies was brutal. His Burundian transcripts showed him marked dead with a black cross over his photo. Despite this trauma, he excelled on placement exams. By fall 1995, Dio had improbably become a Columbia freshman. When a classmate asked if he was the son of an African king, he replied, "I don't know why I'm here, but I'm here." He didn't reveal that a year earlier, he'd been sleeping in Central Park. Starting college felt like a demotion after 3 years of medical school. Language barriers caused him to misname chemicals and misunderstand exam questions. Despite the dean's warning about academic probation, Dio refused to slow down. By spring term, he'd made the dean's list. Columbia transformed him intellectually. He searched for meaning in philosophy, particularly Plato, seeking structure in a world made untrustworthy by genocide. In moral philosophy class, he challenged his instructor's claim that only humans are rational, arguing that animals might be more rational than humans who committed genocide. Reading Hannah Arendt's work on the Holocaust left him questioning what would have happened if people had said no to their leaders, the same question he asked about his own people. His education helped him recognize misery, poverty, disease, oppression as the primary cause of violence, allowing him to avoid self-poisoning hatred. After graduating from Columbia without permanent residency, Dio juggled multiple jobs while taking pre-med courses at night and working at a Manhattan hospice. In 2001, he entered Harvard School of Public Health, where he discovered Paul Farmer's Infections and Inequalities, a book articulating what he'd witnessed in Burundi, how poverty creates conditions for disease and disease deepens poverty. Their first meeting proved serendipitous. After one of Farmer's lectures, they conversed in French through the night about healthcare inequalities. Farmer created a position for him at Partners in Health, where Dio worked with Haitian patients and supported research. Small moments revealed their deepening bond, like when Farmer, exhausted from tireless work, fell asleep on Dio's shoulder during a car ride. A breakthrough came when he shared his complete story with staff during what was supposed to be a brief lunch talk. The scheduled hours stretched into several as colleagues listened intently, creating safe space for him to break years of silence. Combined with securing permanent residency and Farmer's mentorship, this opened the path to medical school at Dartmouth. He realized, finally, this is who I am. This kind of work is not just work, it's part of me, my life, me. In June 2006, 12 years after his escape, Dio returned to Burundi with Tracy Kidder. Approaching Mount Ganza, childhood memories flooded back. His usual talkativeness gave way to silence as he explained Gusimbura, a cultural taboo against speaking names of the dead. In the Western world, people try to remember. Here in Burundi, they try to forget. Bujumbura had transformed. Corrugated metal walls tall enough to shield gunfire, Grand Avenue stripped of trees, Prince Rugasora's statue replaced by a towering Heineken bottle. Passing a mud hut with a Coca-Cola sign, Dio observed, "Coca-Cola can reach here, but not medicines." Most transformatively, Dio withdrew from Dartmouth to build a clinic in Kayanza, near his birthplace. When a Belgian company quoted $50,000 for the access road, 166 villagers completed it themselves with basic tools. By November 2007, Village Health Works opened, treating 47 patients daily. A former Hutu militiaman who initially questioned why a Tutsi would build in a 99% Hutu area eventually volunteered. An elderly man who'd fought Tutsis since 1965 told Dio he wished he'd spend his life doing this instead. The clinic became neutral ground where former enemies could mingle without fear, a place of reconciliation for everyone, including Dio himself. Dio's story reminds us that survival is just the beginning. True healing requires transforming pain into purpose.
The question isn't whether you'll carry scars, but what you'll build with the hands that bear them.